Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to the second half of Saturday Morning with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me. I would love to hear from you. Saturdays with Joy Keys at hotmail.com. You want to remember the social media because I'm going to be doing a giveaway of the author's book that I'm speaking with this morning. So keep your eyes peeled. You will have a chance to win. And you guys know I'll just do random things when I feel like it, maybe a gift card here and there. So you want to keep track of the social media so you can possibly win. And again, the email is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. If you miss a show, the shows are on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and a lot of other places where you get your podcasts. So all you have to do is look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and all the shows are there. There are over 600 shows, a lot of different topics. I hope you enjoy, and I hope you will share them with friends and family. Well, this morning I am speaking with a writer who recently had got a two-book deal with Amazon, I believe it is, and we're going to be talking about one of his books today. He's shortlisted for the Miles Moreland Scholarship, longlisted for the Short Story Day Africa Prize, and has won the Afreda Photo Story Competition. Umar Short Films have screened in numerous festivals, and his work in television, both as a writer and director, has been broadcast on various stations. And he lives in British Columbia, and right now we're going to be speaking about his book, Such a Beautiful Thing to Behold. Good morning, Umar Taraki.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being willing to do this interview. I know it's Saturday morning, and most people sleep in, or you're about to eat pancakes or waffles or whatever. So I appreciate you waking up and talking to me, little old me, just about your book this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you are from, I heard, what they call the Tin City, J-Town. Is it still called that?
Oh, absolutely. It's I'm from J-Town.
You're from J-Town.
Nigeria.
Okay.
I'm from J-Town,
okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about J-Town. What was it like growing up there?
J-Town is, it's a very, my memories of it as a child, you know, it's a very cosmopolitan area, you know, and just historically, it was an important colonial center. Apart from the activities of tin mining that went on, it was a favored spot by the colonial administration because of its very favorable climate. You know, it's up in the hills, and so it was very cool. You know, very temperate kind of weather, and just a very beautiful place in general. So over the years, that kind of attracted a great deal of people from all kinds of backgrounds, from all across the country, you know, and it's been, just the culture has always been welcoming. It's home to, you know, at least three or four different ethnic groups, and it's the capital of the state that, you know, it's situated in. So, yeah, very, very fond memories growing up, and, you know, I loved it.
So were you a big reader when you were little? Did they have a library, or did you have a lot of books, or did you go to films a lot because you're also a filmmaker? Where did this love come for writing and film?
In terms of reading, I was not a big reader when I was little, you know, much to my mother's pain. Because she would get me all these books. I still remember the books and what they looked like, you know, different kinds of books, science books, stories. And I just never read them, you know. And I honestly started reading ravenously when I went to secondary school. And that was in a different town, away from Jos, and it was a boarding school. And reading kind of became for me a kind of escape, because I wasn't a very socially savvy kind of person. You know, I prefer to keep to myself. So sometimes I would be waiting for events, you know, on campus to end so I could go back and continue reading, you know, a Harry Potter book, you know, or A Thousand and One Arabian Nights. And that was it. And that's how I kind of got into reading. And eventually that gave way to wanting to write my own stories. In terms of film, I think film has always been kind of with me, you know, and from a young age. I never tried to make my own films from a young age. I didn't know you could do that. And I didn't have a camera. You know, the circumstances around me never sort of made it possible to try and do that. And so it was much, much later in my life, I think in my early 20s, that I actually started trying to make films. So.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times African parents, the stereotypical thing is, you know, you're a doctor, you're an engineer, you're a lawyer, you have at least two or three degrees. I mean, I see you're an MFA candidate, but like what's the next one? You should already be planning your next master's degree, you know, like what are you waiting for? Come on, chop, chop, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely, you know, and I mean, Nigerians are famously known, you know, for being highly educated around the world. And it's very true, you know, and I guess there are different sort of reasons that have shaped that. But yes, you know, I lost my father was a mining geologist, and he had a PhD in his field. So he was a very accomplished man. And I lost him when he was, you know, when I was very young. But sometimes sometimes I wonder, you know, what he would have made of my decision to become a writer. You know, I'm sure he would have been supportive, but something you just kind of think about, okay, you know, what would he have said as an African parent, you know?
What did your mom say, or what did she say?
Oh, she was, I think at first it was a bit of a head scratcher for her, but she was honestly very supportive. I think she saw that it was something that meant a lot to me, and I think perhaps more importantly, I feel like she trusted me. I feel like she trusted me to make the right choices, to be responsible, you know, with whatever I kind of took on that I wanted to do. So yeah, the whole way, you know, and the book is actually dedicated to her. It's just my way of saying thank you for just everything that she's given me. She has been there for me. You know, she was there for me when the chips were down, when I was broke and trying to make it as a filmmaker, as an artist. You know, just those really tough times. You know, she was always there, supporting, encouraging, and yeah, so it meant a lot.
You have a lot of your short stories and different books. So this writing one book, how long did it take you, and when did you first have the idea for it?
So with this novel, I first had the idea, I think, around 2010, I think. That's how far back.
Wow, that's far back.
The first, yes. And what happened was, it first came to me as an idea for a short story, and this was after I had done a couple of books, like in my teens and my early 20s, where, you know, I tried to write these books, and at the end of it, I just felt I needed to work and improve my craft as a writer. So I decided to step away from long-form writing and try and write short stories, you know. And so the first short story I ever wrote was the first iteration of what became the Stumble. And so I did that. I worked on it for a few months, and then I left it, did other things. Then I got into Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's workshop in 2016, I believe.
The Farafina workshop.
The Farafina, yes, exactly, the Farafina
mm-hmm.
workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of that, you know, it was just so, it was so affirming. It was so affirming. I came out feeling like a superhero, you know. I came out feeling like I could do this. I could take on this work. And suddenly I felt like, you know, maybe it's time to try and work on a book again. So I thought, fine, I would just take this short story idea and make it into a novella, and something that I could do quickly, you know, and before I would sort of get onto the important first novel. So it took about 5 years. You know, I didn't know it would take that long, and the book just kept growing. So it's definitely not a novella now, right? And it's it went from short story to novella, to eventually a novel, and all in all, it took about 10 years.
What was your favorite book when you were reading, or even up to this point in your life, what has been your favorite book that maybe you've read more than once?
The first to come to mind is Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember, you know, as a teenager, you know, reading the books, and I kind of started, I read them out of order. I think I found the second one first, and then I started reading it. I didn't know that it was part of a trilogy, and then I think I found the first one. And so, but there was something about it, you know, compared to like other works of fantasy that were meant for, you know, that were more like young adults, there was something about it that was not afraid to sort of engage with like the harshness, you know, of reality.
Mm-hmm.
There was some violence, you know, there was this very, I don't know, there was just this gritty texture to it that kind of got my attention. And it was just sort of, you know, as a kid, you know, it's something that just, it makes you look, you know, like, okay, what's happening here? This is really interesting. You've got talking polar bears.
The little whispery things that take your body over in the city. I saw the film, the TV show. It was a series that they developed. It was very dark. I mean, the evil lady who was the mom of the girl, I don't know if that's in the book as well. I mean, she was like the Cruella de Vil type of, you know, come to life character. And I thought she was going to be good at one point, and then she was like, hell no, I'm not going to do that.
and that's the thing about those books, because the humans are so complicated, you know, and you've got this young girl who is surrounded by these adults, you know, people that are meant to protect her, you know, her parents in some case. And they're doing, you know, with one hand, they're doing terrible things, and with the other, they're protecting her. And you're trying to reconcile, but it's, you know, I think it's very true of humanity. But it was so fresh coming, you know, seeing that, you know, in that work, encountering that kind of complexity in that work. And, of course, just the imagination and the sense of wonder that those books have, you know, to this day, you know, it has stayed with me.
You know, you have complex characters too, and they make choices that they're questioning themselves, like, why did I just do that? Like, why did I just kill this person? But was it for a good reason did I kill this person? And then you have the other characters who are like the mad people, like Goshi, if you will, and you're just like, he's just completely bad. But before I keep going, why don't you just tell the audience a little bit about what's happening in your story to give them an idea of what's happening?
The story is about a small community, a village more or less, that is quarantined from the rest of the world because there's a strange epidemic unfolding. Nobody knows where it came from, and it's very strange in that it's more of a quote unquote spiritual sickness where your eyes begin to go dark and eventually culminates with an act of suicide. But children are sort of spared from this. And the story follows a family of four siblings and two other characters who are connected to them and their own, you know, attempts of navigating this and making sense. And a couple of them are truly trying to leave a community and trying to escape. And so, yeah.
I mean, we had this pandemic, you know, people were isolated. People couldn't connect with their families. People had to leave places to go to other places. And people thought children could not get, you know, the pandemic. They thought they couldn't get it. They thought they couldn't get COVID, even though we did find out that's not true. But in general, kids were not getting it. And so people, you know, were making up all kinds of stories about that for COVID. But the story, yeah, it's gray. It's a little dark, Umar. You were taking me down a very dark path. Until you had the love story, I was like, okay, thank God, there's some light in here. The love story between, I think, what is it, Panem and Zumji? Are those the two characters that
Panem and Zumji.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, thank God, okay. And I was like, okay, they're going to escape. You know, I was all hopeful. And that's what happens in life, you know, Umar. Like, you know, something crazy bad happens, and you just need that glimmer of hope to keep you going, like, to the next level. I don't know. When in your life, do you feel there's been times where it's just that hope, or there was, like, an angel, quote-unquote, that came, or some kind of information that helped, you know, relieve the pain, and then that gave you that was a catalyst to keep you going. Do you feel that? Like for example, Serafina workshop, you know, that was like, boom.
Yeah.
That was like the catalyst for you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It has happened so many times in my life. Just looking back and sometimes having no explanation for why certain things came about, you know, even this book, honestly, even the way, you know, this book came together and, it was just sort of, it was a miracle after a miracle, you know, that's the only way I could put it. And and things happen, you know, and sometimes it was, you know, it was very, sometimes the stakes are so high, you know, because you're probably at a very desperate moment, and you just need that break, and then it comes together in ways that, yeah, they just take your breath away, honestly. And you can name it, you know, throughout my career, you know, even growing up, you know, losing my dad when I was a kid and feeling like that was the worst thing that could happen to me, you know, and not knowing, you know, how do you go on living, you know, with this new reality and somehow mm-hmm. you look back, you know, 20, 25 years later and you're like, okay, you know, like we're still here. We're still here and we're doing well, you know.
That's happened in the book, you know. The characters, they're young characters and their first time dealing with death. Many of them have not dealt with death and also death of people that were very close to them and kind of violent, if you will, to some degree, you know, the act of trying to kill yourself, that thought, or... And the one character, he somehow became this, if you say, saving grace for other people. And somehow he just kept being in the right place at the right time. And people are like, dude, can you kill me? Like, I just need a break. And he's like, what the hell? This happened to me again? You know? I mean, but then it became like at first it was bad and he was ashamed, but then I feel like he was like, okay, maybe this is my new calling, if you will, so to speak. You know? Uncle Vishak, okay, yo, I was happy about him going out. Look, Uncle Vishad. Okay, I'm not going to say what happened with Uncle Vishad, but I'm just saying I needed to call my squad, and I wanted to take out Uncle Vishad. Okay, like seriously.
I feel like it's definitely one of those moments where a character just got always coming to them. But again, you know, like you said, you know, what is the cost, you know, of sort of, you know, what is the cost of that, you know, of everybody involved? I'm here trying not to give away spoilers, but what is the cost of that for everyone that's sort of involved in that kind of situation, right? And it's, you know, and I think for me, it's a lot of it.
Why was he doing that? I was like, yo, what happened to him that was making him do that? Same with Goshi. What was going on? What happened with Goshi? Because even Nana was like, I don't know what happened to Goshi, but something happened to Goshi and making him do these things, you know? Now, you have this idea of family, and there's the family that people, like you said, it's focusing on like a family, but then there's extended family in the community. In your life, do you feel that people in the community have helped you? Have you had extended family there to support you and bring you love, even in crazy times?
Definitely. Definitely. And, you know, I mean, coming from Nigeria, where, you know, where the culture is honestly very, very communal, your families are big. And in my own case, we didn't have a very big nuclear family. I have three siblings, and two of them were, you know, have been living away from Nigeria for a while. So a lot of times it was me and my younger sister and my mom. And then we were surrounded by, you know, extended family, you know, her siblings, cousins, my own cousins, and those are the memories of childhood. And even the father figures that kind of came in to, you know, just fill in because I didn't have a father, people that were just there constantly, you know, they sprung from that. And even in a lot of cases, not even necessarily people that you were also like related to by blood. You know, we had family friends that we were very close to, people that that were just there, people that were just available, you know, and I cannot count them with all my digits, you know, there's so many. Seriously. You know, in one case, there was one man in particular who we lost, you know, and he was, you know, he was one of my, I have many fathers, and he was one of them. We lost him to COVID, unfortunately, sometime last year, but, you know, he was one of those that stepped in and paid my school fees, you know, when I was in secondary school and my mother couldn't afford it. So there's so many stories like that, and definitely, community is huge.
With this COVID situation, people got very desperate. I mean, from the little things like toilet paper, you know, it was like, where are we going to get toilet paper? And, oh, my God, no toilet paper? That was like the focus. I mean, it was like on every news story, every channel you turn to, it's like toilet paper. It was not about, you know, some big things like, you know, gold or jewelry or a sofa or even a computer or anything. It was about, I can't find toilet paper, you know? And then it was also about trying to find, you know, wipes, Clorox wipes or hand sanitizer. I mean, it was like that was it, you know, but it was, and food. Yeah. But even food was like secondary to toilet paper, it seemed like, you know? And like in your book, you talk about, you know, the small things that people finally see, even though they are no longer seeing. I think that's the key for me. Is that what you were trying to put across? Like the things that you couldn't really, you weren't looking at before, but now that you're going blind, you're all of a sudden seeing these things and how important they are.
Definitely, I think it's one of the big things that I wanted the book to carry. Just this idea that we live our lives, and you know, and I don't want to preach, but I hope I'm not preaching. But you know, we live
Pastor
our lives.
Pastor Umar, and... Pastor Umar, come on, Pastor Umar, tell us your sermon.
You know, we live our lives, and we begin to take so much for granted, and sometimes, you know, it takes an event, it takes something, it takes a kind of situation to make you begin to look at things. I guess the question is, we're always sort of thinking about, you know, how do I get happy, or where do I find my happiness, and this source of happiness and the source of joy. And honestly, you know, it's the things that we already have. It's the things that are around us, you know. And the richest men in history will tell you, you know, the things that we continue to sort of go after, you know, they ultimately, I think we always get to a point where we realize, but, you know, it's always those small things. It's always those things that are within reach. It's always the people that are within reach. It's always the relationships, you know, those are the things that stay, those are the things that matter, those are the things that carry us. In a sense, that was kind of what I was going for. And I wanted to, you know, in a very kind of inverted way, I wanted to talk about just gratitude and the importance of gratitude. And there's this wonderful quote I came across recently, you know, that said, gratitude is not just a switch to turn on when things go well. It is also a light that shines in the darkness. And I thought that was just so, so beautiful. I thought it captured the heart of the book, you know, in such a striking way. But yeah, that's what I was
saying. Amen. Amen. And now the church says, amen. Hallelujah. I think you have another calling, Umar. I don't know. You did the filmmaker. You got the writer now. I think, you know, there might be the Church of Taraki coming, you know, somewhere. And
right.
I think your mom might be happy about that, you know. She'd be like, oh, my son is the priest. Oh, you know, like, really, seriously.
All right. I'll keep that open.
You keep it open, you know.
Yeah.
Look, and if it happens, I just want you to get up one day and say, you know, I was speaking to this young lady. Well, I'm not young, but you could just say young just to make the story good. And she said to me, this is where I would be. And I never believed her. And here I am. You know, like that. You've got to tell it like that, you know?
All right. I'm taking notes.
You're taking notes. Okay, good. So let's talk about some cool things. Again, going back to where you're from, J-Town. I was reading that there's this dish called, is it Gwoti? Gwote, it's made from sorrel leaves, yakuwa, and acha, hungry rice, and garden egg. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, I know a lot about it, and it's interesting that you should bring it up, because I have a business that processes acha. Or, you know, as you called it, hungry rice.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I prefer the international name Fonio.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, and it's something that I, you know, and you can make a lot of things, including gote. And gote is this very nutritious, delicious kind of. It's like a porridge, you know, and. And a big part of it is also you make it with beef and with bones, and you know, so you can make a lot with fonio, and a big part of fonio, and you know what attracted me to that grain in particular was because of its uniqueness. and the history, because it's a uniquely West African grain.
It
is native to West Africa. It doesn't grow anywhere else in the world.
Okay.
And just historically, you know, even, you know, by the time colonialism came in and took over, you know, the grain was kind of pushed to the side. And even though it was continued to be enjoyed locally, you know, not a lot of interest or, you know, just research in terms of trying to understand it went into it. You know, I think any kind of whatever research as there has been, you know, an interest in the grain itself hasn't, it's not more than 15 years, you know, back. So I just saw something that was just uniquely ours, you know, as Africans, and I thought there was something there, and because it had so much potential and had so much value. So I'm very happy that you're bringing up Gwete. I'm stoked that you found out about it, and you can make a couscous style meal with achar. You can replace it with rice. You can bake with it. You know, you can make what we call tuwo, which is like in the south of Nigeria they call it fufu.
You can make that with it, exactly.
So there's so much that can be. You can make drinks out of it. You know, it's a very important grain.
Well, Africa, the continent, has so many resources, and that's why so many people have been over there. Right now, you know, the Chinese are all up and down in Africa, taking over, having conferences, you know, setting up shops and so on and so forth. You've got schools and all types of things of Chinese people. And I have nothing against Chinese people, but I think it's something people need to watch to see, okay, who's next on the list to come and take the resources. And if Africa is so rich, why is it still struggling, you know, so much? And part of that, I think, is even just what you spoke about, people not realizing the potential of certain things that are there. For example, you know, this rice that you just spoke about that can make all these types of things, but nobody was paying attention, you know, to it, and ignoring, even in reference to your book, ignoring the small things, you see, ignoring this grain right in front of their face, that could be a potential moneymaker, and you're doing it, you know. Let me ask you this, Umar, and then I know I have to let you go. If you had a superpower, what would it be?
If I had a superpower, I think I would probably go with being able to touch a book and ingest the information automatically.
Okay. You're the first person that said that. And I've had so many writers on, and none of them have ever said that. But you're the first person. Everybody has, like, a different, you know, thing that they want. And that's the beauty of, you know, being human. We all have these different hopes and dreams. So touch the book, and you can absorb all the information. Well, you know, with these data chips we can put in our body nowadays, you never know. It might work. It might happen in the future. Touch the book, and, true. You know. But Pastor Umar, I'm going to let you go, and I will see you on next Sunday. I will see you when you write that next book, young man. When you write your next book, you have to come on, okay?
The two-book
deal. What is the next book about? Can you give us some hints, or do you have any ideas?
The only thing I will say is it's a very old idea. It's older than the idea for this book, for such a beautiful thing to behold, and it features the desert in a very big way.
That's all he's going to say.
Yeah.
All right, Umar, thank you so much again for coming on today. I hope you have great Gwete in your future. And
thank
I will
you so
talk
much.
To you. I'll talk to you when the next book comes out. Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
It was nice talking to you as well. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with author Umar Taraki. We spoke about his book, Such a Beautiful Thing to Behold. And his book really will take you on a journey questioning what is important to you in your life that you maybe you're missing. And if you became blind, what would you consider as important? What would you need? Who would you need? Who will be by your side when you became blind? How will you navigate the world like that? And isolation, it also deals with that. And some people have been dealing with that right now with COVID. So I'm going to be giving away some copies of Such a Beautiful Thing to Behold. So you want to follow me at Joy Keys. Also check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can also email me, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. You can also make donations via PayPal, Saturdays with Joy Keys. You can make donations to help keep the show going, to help give giveaways and so on like that. But they all need funding, so that will be very helpful. You can check out archive shows on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, as well as here. I also want to let you know, if you ever want to call in, the call-in number is always the same, 516-387-1745. Again, 516-387-1745, no matter what the show. That number has not changed, and you can call in and ask a question. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you guys have a great weekend.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner. They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Wonder if you should get tested for colorectal cancer? Well, it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., so if you're 50 or older, it's time. Screening helps find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed. Remove the polyp, prevent the cancer. Did you know there's more than one screening test? Talk to your doctor to find the one that's right for you. No more excuses, because colorectal cancer screening really does save lives. A message from HHS and CDC's Screen for Life campaign.